It's this generation, not the next one, that the people living right now that have to change these problems fast. And I think truth-telling is crucial to mobilize that.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Our deepest condolences to his family, his wife Patricia, his children Robert, Mary, and Michael, his grandchildren, and his great-granddaughter. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for joining us.
You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. This is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein, joined tonight by Kyle.
I'm right here, yeah.
And right here at the moment is on a dirt road in the middle of the Yukon, where we are this week, and we can't tell you why. Well, at least we can't tell you why this week. But we do have an interesting show planned for you in the hour ahead. Stay tuned for Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. As mentioned, this is Emmanuel, and Kyle's over there.
Yeah, right here.
And we're sorry for the subterfuge. It's just that we have so much more to talk about before we explain why we're in the Yukon. And in fact, we're no longer on a dirt road, in case that was bothering anybody. We're currently at something called the Fireweed Community Market Society. And what that is basically just this gathering of vendors, bigger than I've seen in New York. Must be several dozen carts and trucks selling everything from Indian food to donuts to all kinds of crafts and things like that. Kyle, did you notice anything else interesting here?
Yeah, different vendors for foods and specialty creations. I saw something with like ancient whole grain breads and just a wide variety, soaps, all that kind of craft thing that, that someone might specialize in. There's something I'm looking at now that's a milk, Yukon milk. Yeah, Yukon milk. I think it's a raw milk. So, yeah, there's just a ton of stuff here. And I'm looking all the way around. I'm surrounded by tents and tables and activity. And it seems like people are kind of filtering through. There's a play area, so there's a lot of families and young people. A lot of transportation. I'm seeing bicycles everywhere, which is really good. And I'm also seeing helmets, which is encouraging. You don't see that as much, or I don't. But I think we're near like a covered area where there was a performance. And it looks like they're maybe putting it away or setting up for a musician or something that's going to come through. But we've been here before. I've never been to this park. And this is a large park on one end of town, kind of by the river.
Yeah, I've been to White Horse a few times now. White Horse being right in the middle of Yukon. And this is pretty incredible. I think it's the epitome of Canada. You described it before as a lot of outlets with a lot of space. Because what I'm seeing here is I'm seeing a gathering of all these merchants, but there are so many of them. And even if the entire city of Whitehorse turned out, there'd still be room, I think, because there's just so much space here. And I think that's kind of what Canada is, a lot of space and a lot of options. So apparently this happens every Thursday, and we're lucky enough to be here on a Thursday.
Yeah, and it's organized enough that they have power for everything, so you're not hearing generators. Everybody seems to be just enjoying the sunshine, and it's very, very refreshing to get right into town and hang out with the community as a newcomer and see what people are doing.
Well, what we're doing is we're sitting at a picnic table, just kind of recapping what we've been doing over the past week or so. Actually, it has been only a week since we left New York. We basically took our first plane ride since the pandemic, and that's a bigger deal than you might think, because I had no idea what to expect. Just flying out of JFK and heading over to Seattle. Usually we do that by train, but figured why not do it by plane this time, see what it's like. What were your impressions of how flying has changed, or has flying changed in the years since?
Well, I did see a lot of masks that were still in effect for individuals. So it is not nearly as much. It's certainly not required. But some people are remaining cautious. And I respected that. I think everybody did. You understand that, you know, people's circumstances are different. And this is a communal space. So that was really important. Travel, I mean, the airports and everything were busy as ever. I think a lot of people are launching their summer activities, getting out, seeing the world, taking advantage of a lot of the tourism and encouragement that they're getting from that industry, us being no different. And, I did something unusual for the security line. I didn't want to be hassled with you know, having a manual inspection. So I actually went through the thing.
This is huge for Kyle. If you know Kyle, you know that he doesn't like the thing. You want to tell them what the thing is?
Well, it's like the secret agent thing they use at, like, headquarters or whatever. But it's basically millimeter wave, and it's not an X-ray, but it's practically that much visual, ability, and it's taking a picture. I'm a photographer. I'm sensitive about this stuff, and somebody somewhere looks at you and judges you, and then they wave you through.
And Kyle, you have always opted out. That's the phrase you use. Opt out, and what that means is instead of going through that device, you submit to a physical search, meaning being groped by a complete stranger in all sorts of places. But what changed?
I don't know. I realized it was going to take time, and I didn't want to be just pulled out and go through that whole process. It would have just slowed us all down, and I'd kind of just resigned myself to thinking, like, this has been around for a while. I was comfortable with what I was wearing, and I may be more secure about my body. I don't know, but I got past it, and basically I was willing to go. I was ready to go through. I still had my metal belt, and I didn't even offer shoes or any, like, I was trying to disappear a lot of the ways of being since I was going to commit to this. But the woman standing there was incredibly rude, talking about paper. Yeah. I had scratch paper, basically, but not much else was in my pocket since she was demanding I hold it. Even holding it, she was still kind of terse. I finally got in there, and that set me off a little bit. So I made sure while raising my hands that only two fingers, one on each hand, was raised. So that's a part of the image. If anyone has access to it and is looking for me, you'll definitely see that amidst anybody else who was flagged for that behavior. But I felt if this was going to be my first run through this thing, then that was the right message to send.
But you also had two pleasant exchanges in that same experience with two other agents, I believe.
That's true. Prior to that, I was making sure that my state ID was enough to travel, and it was a checker prior to getting into the conveyor and baggage X-ray that the person just verifying ID and ticket boarding pass one last time didn't quite understand me at first, and then he said COVID. And basically what he meant is it was delayed. The Washington State driver's license does not conform to the federal travel standard, but they extended the period that is still valid to show up and present. And that's not the really old ones. They adapted, and then it changed and got even more stringent with the federal travel requirements, and that's in the last half dozen, I don't know how many years. So I was still able to use it, but I offered my passport, and he just went into how he had to work through COVID, and it was very pleasant. The other thing was going through the scanner, the person that caught me after the millimeter wave incident didn't see anything I was doing other than he noticed my shirt, and I happened to be wearing a polo shirt. Sort of a business casual collared black shirt with the 2600 logo. And he said, those are the people obsessed with the weird obsession with payphones. And it was a joke. He said something about a crazy obsession with payphones.
That's what we're known for.
Okay. If that's his first impression, fine. That is probably warranted, but it was one of his first examples of what we were all about. But I was pleasant. I said, yeah, was just verifying. You mean, yes, the Hacker Magazine. And it was great to see the adulation and support in a TSA guy. And he was being very clear that he knew exactly what was up and approved.
Well, I had it wasn't quite the same experience as you, but it was rather frustrating because there I was at TSA. I had only two bags. I always travel with just two bags, never check anything. And there were no baskets to put your things in. So what are you supposed to do? The line is moving, and the people behind the counter aren't putting the baskets up. So, I put my two bags up there. And the woman says, sir, is there a laptop in there? And I said, yeah, there's a laptop in there. Well, sir, you have to put it on the thing. So, well, there's nothing to put it in. You didn't put anything there. How am I supposed to do that? Plus, there's no sign anywhere that says you have to take the laptop out. You're saying that like it's, ingrained in my brain that I'm supposed to do this. I didn't say any of that, but I said, no one's saying anything. No one told us anything. And plus, there's no baskets. So eventually baskets appeared and I was able to do that. But she was telling me one thing. Meanwhile, this other guy has developed a relationship with me and is telling me to do other things. Do I have to take my shoes off? He said, no, you don't take your shoes off. She's saying, I have to take my shoes off. I'm being pulled either into the device that Kyle went through or the regular metal detector. Eventually the metal detector won, but for the metal detector, you're supposed to take your shoes off. But the person who was convincing me to go to the other machine, you don't have to take your shoes off. So that one, I went through the metal detector with my shoes on, which is, I don't know how much of a violation that is. But everything went fine, there were no problems or anything like that. But the weird thing is, I was being told to hold everything that was in my pocket, which was a wad of cash, actually, up in the air, because I was supposed to go through the machine where... you're supposed to take everything out of your pockets, but I wound up going through the other one instead. So there I'm going through the metal detector with a wad of cash in my hands. I don't know how that looked. So then I made it through, and of course, they always are rushing you to put everything back together after they tell you to take everything apart. So there was, you know, awkwardness and anxiety that didn't have to happen, but always seems to at TSA. But we're just as happy to get through it and to be ready to be on our way.
Yeah, it seemed haphazard, but perhaps just case by case and a lot of phasing out of some of these things that people understand when they're getting past that point to the gate.
So anyway, flight was okay. There were no fist fights on our flight. Nobody tried to open the door. Of course, they don't feed you anymore. You have to buy food and buy everything, basically. I think they give you pretzels, maybe, but that's it. It's, you know, when did things get so unpleasant where they can't even give you food? But whatever, you know, you wind up buying some overpriced sandwich or something like that. And what I was amazed with is how quickly you can get across the country. It's just 5 hours, 5 hours from New York to Seattle. I think it's even less if you're going the other way. It's. I know people have flown a lot and people know this, but I'm still amazed by it. As somebody who prefers trains and land routes, this is something that, you know, it's something to behold. But getting to Seattle was awesome because you know the transit system there. You knew exactly where to get a bus. My only thing that I notice about that is to get to that bus, you've got to walk past everything in the airport and wind up on a street. And they don't really help you find the bus. If you're with someone like Kyle who knows his way around, yeah, it's great. The bus was pulling up just as we got there. Very convenient. But they really don't push the mass transit as much as I think they should.
Yeah, there's only about four lines that actually go into the terminal, and that stop itself is very far towards the end. But if you actually want to get anywhere sort of regionally, it's much easier to get out towards the street, where, of course, a lot of the other more common lines run, specifically ones that will take you to different bus stations, which will then pit you with the rest of the system and much easier navigation and connection, so to speak. So that is always kind of welcome because I like how the Orca card works.
The Orca card?
It is the Orca. It is the one card for travel, similar to Oysters and things that like Omni in a physical card, though. That
okay, nobody knows what that means. Oyster is, well, people do, but a lot of people don't. Oyster is London. What was the other one you mentioned?
Omni, that's the New York system that...
That's New York. You're right, New York. But I don't know, do they have the card yet? Is the card out?
We've debated this. We don't know. We've seen ones in pharmacies and drugstores, but you buy them at a fixed rate. I don't know if you can add to them. As far as getting ones that are permanent sent to you, I don't know how soon that's been rolled out.
What's really cool about Orca is that it's a hard card. I've had one in my pocket for a couple of years now, and I was able to just hold it up to the machine on the bus, and instantly it was able to deduct the amount from what was still on my card. So it's really cool to have a solid card like that in your pocket for a particular city that you know will work.
My favorite part, indeed. It works. The amount stays there. You can top it up at the machines. Or you can create an account and associate it with some kind of payment method, much in the way many of the other systems operate. But this familiarity and just having it there, you're able to get right back onto the system. Transfers are somewhat okay. I think there's like an upper limit of how much you can spend per day. I'm not sure about all the details, and I think we've talked about that before. But being able to use that quickly and get into the system was a real advantage. But the best part is it works across different modes. Whether you're using a regional type mode, like a Sounder train, or if you get on a metro bus, you could go way out into the lowlands and into the hills, very rural places. Those buses, you can cross into some of the other systems in the north of Seattle, and some of them interoperate around the Sound.
Now, you mentioned the Sounder train. I'd like to talk about the Sounder train a little bit because we basically stayed in Seattle for a very brief period of time, but our destination was Vancouver. So we planned on taking the Amtrak Cascades train to Vancouver. Only a couple of those run a day. It's deceptive because if you're not careful, you could wind up on a bus, an Amtrak bus, and nobody wants to do that. In fact, we even saw an Amtrak bus, and literally the slogan on the front of the bus. I'm not making this up. It says, next time, take the train. I don't know why they would say that to people. Obviously, they're waiting to get on the bus, and here's the bus approaching. That's already admonishing them for taking the bus. Whatever. But we had to take the Sounder train to get to King Street Station, which is where you pick up Amtrak. Now, Sounder is great. It looks really nice, very clean trains. My criticism is that there are too few of them. They don't run enough. In fact, to get into town in the afternoon, I think there's only maybe three or four trains total, and they have to share with the freight lines. It's that whole thing. But it's a missed opportunity, I think, because they really should have a lot of Sounder trains. If there were more, people would be using them more. There'd be less cars on the road. There are so many cars on the road in Seattle. And we wound up taking a Sounder into King Street Station. Of course, it had some issues getting started, but once they figured that out, we were able to get there. And at King Street Station, they really don't make it easy to find King Street Station. We wound up on the street, and that across the street is the building, and we wound up in the building, and there weren't enough signs. I mean, we weren't in a hurry or anything like that, but it was just kind of crazy. And then, of course, the whole adventure of Amtrak Cascades began. So we actually had a train booked that was coming from Portland and heading up to Vancouver, which was pretty awesome. I was looking forward to that. A lot of confusion inside the King Street Station in Seattle. Again, I don't know what it is when we're going from one place to another. That's where the confusion seems to happen a lot. And there was this desk where you're supposed to check in with your passport because you're going into another country. And, you know, the place was crowded because there were other trains and buses that were leaving and arriving and things like that. So, you know, having a place to sit with our bags was a valuable thing. And I didn't want to lose that by getting up on this short line to check in, because as soon as we stood up, somebody would take our seats. So I just walked over and said, here's my, you know, ID, and here's my ticket. And since we booked two tickets at once, the ticket had two names on it. So she asked where you were, and I pointed to where you were. You were guarding the seat. And she said, oh, he has to come over too. It's like, well, okay, but we didn't want to lose our seats. And she got really mad at that. So, okay, you know, I waved you over. And as soon as you came over, there's this announcement that came over the PA saying, do not leave bags unguarded. So, you know, being admonished for leaving bags, being admonished for not coming over. So eventually we sorted it out, but it was typical. They were making these announcements. Nobody could understand what the announcements were over the PA system. Then, on top of that, there was another train that was heading south, and they stopped with the PA announcements and started making actual announcements by shouting. Except the guy shouting the important information to all the passengers in King Street Station was wearing a mask. In fact, he was the only one there wearing a mask. He was the only person there that probably shouldn't have been making an announcement, because nobody could understand what he was saying through the mask. Like, you have this guy just shouting unintelligible things. You know, at first I thought it was, you know, somebody who wasn't quite with it, because I didn't see who was shouting. I just heard all this weird sound that was a human voice, but not making any sense. And it's funny to watch people trying to comply with what they think that somebody is saying and not wanting to seem like they don't know what's going on. But that's pretty much what was happening in that place for quite a while.
Yeah, the acoustics of the restored King Street Station for Amtrak there are full of marble and all these wonderful reflective surfaces, and any kind of amplification, especially when it's muffled like that, it just completely dissipates into a muddied oral experience. So we were trying to make out what things were going on. A woman behind us was starting to talk to us, and we were kind of comparing notes and that sort of thing, and strategizing thereafter.
Yeah, that's right. We did strike up conversations with people as we started standing in line, because we figured out, we befriended the person who was mad at us. That's what you have to do. And I was telling Kyle this, that yes, we're mad at this person for admonishing us for not both standing up at the same time and either giving up our seats or leaving our bags unattended. But okay, let's just take the blame for it and be nice. And of course, that helped, because she gave us information that was very helpful to us, i.e. where the gate was and when they were going to be opening up. So we were, I think, third or fourth online. But of course, that changed once the train got closer and all these other people somehow managed to mass in front of us. And also, you know, we realized the train is coming from Portland. It's already going to have people on it. So it's going to be a little hard maybe to find seats or seats together. And this is a train that people love the view, so everybody's freaking out over making sure they get a good view. Now, most people like to look out at the Pacific Ocean, but I realized it's afternoon, the sun's going to be in your eyes, so I was going to shoot for the other side. And of course, once we got on the train, it was, as predicted, mayhem. People were looking for seats, not finding any. We wound up finding a seat in a kind of a handicapped area, which I didn't want to do, but it was the only thing available on that car. So I went ahead to the car in front. I was able to find better seats in the middle. I was able to call you on the phone, and we were able to transfer over there. Meanwhile, we saw other people practically in tears because they couldn't find a seat with a view, and they'd been waiting there for hours looking for a view, and people were giving up their seats so that other people could see. It was really nice, a good community spirit. But eventually, we all got on the damn train. The train started moving. Really nice view, really a fun ride overall.
But two things I did notice. The intercom there also was terrible.
Oh, my God.
And our particular car had lackluster air conditioning. But beyond that, they were the older Amtrak cars in between two, I believe, Cascades engines.
That's right. They swapped out the old Cascade cars for I think they're called Horizon cars from Amtrak. And yes, what you mentioned about the PA system in the cars. Again, we were faced with a situation where we couldn't understand the word that was being told to us. And we knew it was important because we're approaching a border. What do we do? You know, are the customs agents coming on board the train? You know, I pick out occasional words. You know, I heard passport, I heard 15 minutes, and I didn't know what any of that meant. So I thought, okay, they're going to come through. It's going to take about 15 minutes. None of that happened. We wound up crossing the border, and we even saw the border where all the cars were. You know, we saw where the cars were stopping and entering the country, going both ways, but we kept going. I figured, you know, maybe just a few miles, but no, it was like an hour we kept going. We're deep in Canada. And I was wondering, what is our status right now? We're way into Canada, but we haven't gone through customs. Are we still in America in our train car? You know, what exactly happens here? And it turns out we had to wait until we actually arrived in Vancouver, which took such a long time. The train was going slowly. It was stopping. It was starting again. It was really weird. It's like they haven't figured out quite how to make the connection between Seattle and Vancouver. It's supposed to take 4 hours. It took 5 hours. They wanted it to take 3 hours when they upgrade the track, but yeah, we got in late. It was easy getting across the border, very pleasant, no problems at all. We were prepared for that. We just didn't know how it was going to work, and nobody on the train seemed to know. So if you want a confusing ride, the Amtrak Cascades from Seattle to Vancouver, that's your best option as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I said at one point, everything about this smacks of inefficiency. There's something going on. The way they're moving in physically into Vancouver, they needed all of these starts and stops, and it took a really incredibly long time, much longer than it felt like it had to. I believe there is a bridge and some other construction going on that is major, so I'll give them a break. But it was at long last, that arrival, that we stepped out of the state. Well, we got to the border control after detraining. And that was another long wait. Everybody was a bit tired. And it was a very simple process, us showing our various forms. I was using an old school passport. And, you know, there's various ways you can present your ID and so forth.
I have a passport card.
I'm really envious of that. And I'm thinking next renewal, I'm going to go for some of that stuff, too. We also learned about Nexus, which I was seeing signs for in the airports and so forth, and I'm not aware. We haven't been using that mode and going across borders that much as recently.
Well, this is our first time into Canada. Canada had been closed for a couple of years. I mean, It was major, really, being in Canada. In fact, we're in Canada right now. It's incredible just knowing, wow, we did it. It's our first time out of the country, you know, first time riding a plane. These are milestones.
Yeah, and I had that kind of typical anxiety, I guess, just making sure everything's right and, you know, you've got all the information that they're going to be inquiring about, and just that you're ready to present yourself there. So once we got there, it was very, very easy to just relax a little bit and realize, okay, we're here, it's okay, and we were able to be accepted.
And that's when the trouble started. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's not unpleasant. What we went through, not an unpleasant situation, just something that, boy, I wish it worked better. I'm talking about Google Maps. Yeah. Okay, you know, I've used Google Maps before. I've used all kinds of navigational software. I'm not an idiot. I know what I'm doing. And, you know, we had a hotel booked in, you know, it wasn't quite in the middle of town, but it was near downtown Vancouver. And basically, I wanted to take something known as the Expo Line. Vancouver has this amazing driverless train system. It used to be the biggest in the world. It's been surpassed since by, I think, Singapore and Malaysia and maybe one or two other places. But it's really incredible. Last time we were in Vancouver, there was only one line. Now I think there are three or four. So I wanted to take the Expo Line to get to our hotel because I knew it was fairly nearby. And so I asked Google, you know, I hit the mass transit icon, said, get me there by mass transit from the train station. And it drew a little blue line, you know, like the Expo Line is blue. Said 13 stops. All right. It was so easy. It was so incredibly easy. We walked out of the train station. We saw the SkyTrain. It's called the SkyTrain. Again, driverless, completely automated. We walked over to the station, and there's a machine there. You buy what's known as a Compass card, which is pretty much the same thing as the Orca, except it's for Vancouver.
And that process itself, imagine, I mean, you're making a late landing in an unfamiliar city. We know some attributes of the city, but we weren't exactly familiarized, and things have changed. And of course, Vancouver is really druggy, and it's really got some sadness going on. And so I just want to say that was part of what we were navigating, is a lot of people slumped over hanging out in front of this stop that we had to get into to buy the ticket.
And Seattle has the same issues, dealing with it in different ways. We can discuss this too, but basically, we got the ticket no problem. We had two Compass cards. I put $20 Canadian on it because we're going to Zone 3. 13 stops on the Compass line takes us all the way out to Zone 3. So it was simple. It was so easy. We went up to the platform. The train is arriving. The train was crowded. It was like a New York City subway. It was crowded with people, but we were able to make our way on. And the train was a serious train. It went, you know, a good speed, a good distance. And I was like, wow, you know, this is something. This is real. But as we moved further and further on the train, I started asking more and more questions because Google has said it's 13 stops or a 40-minute walk. And as we hit 10 stops, I realized, you know, there is no way anybody could do this in 40 minutes. It's taking us 40 minutes on the train to get out here. How can anybody walk this? So by the time we actually arrived at the stop, the 13th stop, I had to question if we were given the right directions. And as it turned out, no, we were not. We were way far away from where we had to be. It was like we had gone to the Queens-Nassau border instead of Midtown Manhattan. So, first thing we had to do was figure out how to get back, and this was the problem, because our train was an hour late, it was already after midnight, the SkyTrain shut down at 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was 12:50, and we went as far as we could, went to a place I believe called New Westminster, where the train heading back to the city stopped and would not go further. And I don't know why New Westminster, that's just where all the trains stop.
Yeah, and the train itself, it was feeling like the last train of the night because it had been full. It was elbow to elbow.
Yeah, so there we were. The guy kicking everybody out of the station said there's buses downstairs. And he wasn't wrong. There was a bus downstairs. It was out of service. And there were all these people wandering around in various states of intoxication or questionable lifestyles or whatever you want to say. Not really being very helpful to people who are lost and not knowing where to go. So anyway, to cut the story short, we basically were screwed. We were way far away from where we had to be. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. There were no buses, no cars. The city closed up fast. I realized I had the Lyft app. So I clicked on my Lyft app for the first time in like a year and said, hey, I need a car. I need to get somewhere. And all I got was just gray bars. Like, not even a response, just grayness. Like, something was going to happen, but it never did. I later found out what that means is that there are no drivers anywhere nearby, and good luck. But they don't say that. They just don't respond. So then what I wound up doing was installing the Uber app. I've never used Uber in my life, but I had to download it on the street corner, install it, sign up for it, put my payment options in, call a car. Car came in like 10 minutes. Wasn't that much. It was more than I wanted to spend, but it wasn't that much. Got us to our hotel. We got to see the entire damn city because we had gotten so far out of our way. So I guess, you know, you look at it in a positive way. We got to ride a train we never would have ridden ordinarily. It was way crowded with people. We saw all sorts of things. We wandered around on a street where there weren't very many people at 1 o'clock in the morning and got a long car ride back to our hotel and were plenty tired and got a good night's sleep.
Absolutely. And I'm so thankful that we were quick on our feet, because when you're in that moment and you're, again, like kind of in an unfamiliar place, you have all these bags, maybe not. Even if you travel light, you're going to have things in your hands and then try to work your phone while holding something and then interpret a sign while somebody's coming up to you about something. And it, all of that compounds, and travel fatigue and stress can really set in and make it hard. And when we evaluated it, we kind of retraced and figured out what had happened. But you don't want to be a sitting duck like that, and you really try your best to coordinate and get into your ground transport.
Now, and here's what happened. Here's what the screw-up was. It's partly my fault, but I think it's very much Google's fault. Because what they did was they drew a blue line. And that blue line represented a bus. I thought the blue line represented the Expo line because the Expo line is a blue line. I was supposed to go 13 stops on the bus. If I had read the number next to where the line began, I'd realize, oh, it's a bus. But they don't really differentiate between buses and metros or sky trains, whatever you want to call them. It wasn't that clear. Yes, I should have caught it. But also, why are you making the line look exactly the same as the Expo line? It was, you know, unfortunate, but somewhat understandable. But hey, you know, you have what's known as a hard landing sometimes when you go to these cities, and it's part of the experience. And it was looking back on it, it was an adventure. But we had more of an adventure to go through in Vancouver. We only had a day to spend. And the next day, we spent it with our friend Genevieve.
That's right. And she was so happy to see us. We were thrilled to meet her early in the morning, midday-ish and mid-morning, so to speak. But we met up early, and she was driving a car, one of these rideshare cars, which was kind of fascinating. You had to unlock or activate it with an app or using your phone. And we were on our way looking for places to have breakfast. And in fact, we went through a couple different options. Some of them had some issues with some damage and they were closed, or otherwise we couldn't go there. But we ended up going to a lumber yard, which had a small diner in it. And we basically climbed up some stairs and were able to be seated in a small breakfast spot right on top of the facilities of this lumberyard.
It really was a lumberyard with a breakfast nook in the middle of it. And big signs that said absolutely no parking in the lumberyard for anybody going to the breakfast place. But little gems like that, that's why it's so important to hang out with people from the town. But yeah, Genevieve was amazing. She showed us all these incredible parts of the city, and we learned so much about Vancouver, its uniqueness. I'll tell you, that city just has so much going for it. First of all, it's huge. We learned that the night before. But also, it just has this incredibly welcoming spirit to it. I just feel like it's reaching out to the people there to make sure things are accessible. And there's a lot of variety, a lot of places to go, a lot of scenery, a lot of thought to things like preservation, recycling, the environment. Things that would be condemned in the States as woke, but they work.
Yeah, things we make controversial that don't have to be. And there's a lot of carrying on and just getting things to a usable point to really make the city shine, but responsibly. One of which, I mean, we're really soaking up architecture, just driving around and getting from place to place. And we were learning about different vantages and how in any one place in the city you do have a certain percentage of the sky visible. You're not just surrounded by these artificial surfaces and using cheats like reflective glass or something, which I think is a little bit more common in stateside. So taking in that while we were driving around and, of course, getting these local spots and local vantages really were something to appreciate. We learned all about the car shares, the details of that, but also other forms of transportation. Seeing the cycling paths being used, I love seeing that. It's a reminder of how it should be. Bicycles everywhere in certain neighborhoods and certain routes. With a lot of helmets being worn, I was heartened to see that tradition. As I'm seeing here in the Yukon with all of these bicycles, I'd love to see more of that in the States. We also noticed how those signals are controlled. The flashing green at intersections. This was pointed out to us by Jen, and we didn't really realize the details of it and how it worked, and of course how people bypass some of the ways it works.
Yeah, the flashing green seems to be somewhat unique to that area. It's basically an intersection where only pedestrians can control the light. There might be cars, because they have a stop sign. They're coming out of the street. They don't have the light, and they never will get the light, unless, as Jen told us, you jump out of your car and press the button and jump back in. Then the flashing green will turn to red, and you'll have right away. Otherwise, you're expected to wait until there's an opening in the traffic. But a pedestrian can press a button, and immediately that light will turn red, and the pedestrian can cross. So the flashing green is supposed to signify to people driving that this is a place where pedestrians cross and to be extra vigilant.
And that is a fantastic consideration in the type of design. And, of course, pedestrians and cyclists, they are respected. They are a part of the road, and you see it everywhere. And the drivers themselves are incredibly vigilant, and you must be. As I understand, the rules are much more favorable in any kind of accident or situation. They're much more favorable for pedestrians and cyclists, and as it should be. It encourages people to be out and amongst one another and enjoying and taking up what the city has to offer. And we actually ventured out. We got a bit of a driving tour early on, but we headed across town into some other parts of the city itself. There are these enclaves, sort of, I wouldn't say boroughs, but various parts of Vancouver that feel a lot more connected. Some of it I understand, and from Jen's perspective, is sort of transit theater, like saying things are transit accessible. Some new construction is being branded that way, but it's not exactly quite thought through yet, I want to say. So the critiques are valid. It's not a utopia per se. But as we ventured out and visited these parts of the city, we found ourselves on the campus of UBC, University of British Columbia. And the campus has what is, I think, the best example of a Japanese garden that changes and is unique throughout all the different seasons.
Well, she told us that the Emperor of Japan had visited Vancouver, had gone to that garden, and while he was in that garden, he said, "I am in Japan." The ultimate compliment.
Yeah, he said this is what the essence is of Japan, yeah.
Or possibly he was senile, but I think he meant it.
And lost, right. But that was incredible. We walked through this just pristine forested, surrounded by tall stands of evergreen trees, but itself it had man-made ponds, bridges over them, and moss covering the bases of these trees and other carefully pruned species surrounding that. And the moss itself was so pervasive so healthy. It looked as though it was like a grass or other kind of ground cover, but it was this very lush moss, and it had been maintained to this incredible, just beautiful manicuring and just shaped with all of the other trees. And a lot of them have cuttings and certain authentic, like traditional techniques used to give the shape and space and ultimately the beauty, natural beauty. And it just is, it's been there for 50 years. And we ended up finding the gazebo and just sat there and talked and caught up. And in this tranquil Japanese garden, I felt like it was science fiction. How did we go from this urban architecture and industrial, society, modern world, to this oasis? And it truly was an oasis in an oasis, because the campus itself, UBC, is incredible. All kinds of different buildings, a lot of concrete and brutalist style, I would say, almost modern, Northwest, contemporary and modern, but a lot of concrete, similar to what is done on the Stony Brook campus with some of the newer stuff, as well as the older kind of even most hated types of concrete structures. But I noticed the programs too were quintessentially Northwest. I saw several. One was the bioenergy research and demonstration facility, which I could get down with. I would have a lot of fun checking out what they're showing off there. And then the other facility I noticed that was remarkable was the wood sciences lab or school.
Wood sciences?
It was something about the wood and wood sciences field and department, and it occupies that, to me, was like, of course, this is Canada, the forest and harvesting of timbers, long tradition, and the amount of wood and just giant pieces that were incorporated into the university's buildings was beyond anything you would imagine on another campus. So, I mean, it's just astounding to walk around there.
So finding these gems in a city, it's always possible, but it's more probable if you're with somebody who knows the place and appreciates the place. So we want to thank Genevieve for being our guide. We really should have her on the show. The thing is, to record a show takes time, and we wanted to spend time there just enjoying the city. We only had that day, but in the future we definitely will have her on to discuss this and other things as well. But I want to just kind of finish up here by focusing on some issues that basically affect places like Seattle, like Vancouver, that make the, they're in the media, they're in discussions of various sorts, and of course is the drug problem. Now, I've seen so many references to this, and so many pictures and videos and things like that, and in real life, I've seen, examples of problems. But what is not focused upon nearly enough, is how people can get through this, how people do prosper. Obviously, not everybody is. Obviously, there are major issues with people who have these problems. But it's a question of how are these people dealt with? Are they thrown into an institution? Are they imprisoned? Do they die on the street because there's no support for them? Or are they in a situation that is somewhat unpleasant, but at least is a possible pathway? And I'm not saying that everybody will benefit in this particular way. But what I saw in Vancouver, I think you saw the same thing, Kyle, just a lot of people who are in a bad way. But I've seen that before. I've seen it dealt with in a much harsher manner, and I've seen no solutions. I don't claim to have the answers. And in Seattle, I feel the same way. A lot of people on the street. But you're just as homeless if you're not in a tent underneath an overpass as if you are. So rather than condemning the cities and saying this is some kind of a political thing that only one side has the problem with and the other side has it all figured out, no, it's something we as two nations and as the human race are struggling with. We have to figure this out. And at least what I see in places like Vancouver and Seattle are attempts to try something different.
Yeah, there are changing winds as far as the emphasis, and it's going into even the way development is handled. There is corruption, and there is big money, and players that are crass and do not care about the human toll. But policies of the past that have emphasized high income and then, you know, assumed that trickling down success would get to these populations have not garnered the benefits. In fact, a lot of expensive, high-end living spaces end up vacant. And the real issue, I mean, these people are sick. There's the supply of chemicals and things that itself is one way to look at it, but that's not the only way. And the acute problem is people need housing. They need a better emphasis on transitional housing and unconventional ways of getting people off the streets and recovering and getting back some kind of healthy lifestyle that doesn't put them into situations where they're exposed to more of the substances or can't see a pathway to a life away from that. And it's really changing, I think, in where people are putting dollars and new construction. They're trying to get as much of the high-end stuff off the table as a solution to this. You can't expect it to come from like job creation and specious promises that new communities. Yeah, you're going to have new building, but it has to be mandated that there's options for people who can't afford that. And I think there's a growing realization that this is an aspect of it that is overlooked. If people can't go someplace and they're spinning out, they're vulnerable to more of the same.
Getting people housed is the most important thing. For people to have a place where they can live, where they can go home, that is essential. And that, I think, is what we all need to be pushing for. And then, of course, dealing with addictions, dealing with various mental issues that are brought about by this. And one way you don't accomplish anything is by criminalizing. So by decriminalizing, that's a step. Now, you might not see the the benefits immediately. It might seem to be something that's bad for the rest of us. But we need to take that step because we need to be able to bring these people back. And, on that note, without getting into particulars, there are a number of people that we met both in Seattle and Vancouver that I could easily see had things gone a different way for them. There being one of those hopeless people who seem to have no way out, but instead they're prospering. They have a job. They have a place to live. And that's all of us, All of us are either one step away or 20 steps away, but always there's a pathway to being one of the people that don't have a home. that have an addiction, that have no way out. So we need to remember that before we start judging and saying, oh, look what Seattle is doing, look what Vancouver is doing, what a disaster. Do you have it figured out? Do you have a plan? Because all the plans I've heard require some degree of callousness or just pretending something's not there. So what I learned by seeing all this is that there are people who are trying, and it's a rough road, but at least we're moving on that road. And that's the best analogy I can point out. And that brings us back to where we are right now in Whitehorse at the Fireweed Community Market Society, which is an odd name. Why are we here? Well, we're out of time, so we can't really talk about it. See, we told you that was going to happen. That's why we didn't want to talk about it at first. We couldn't tell you why we're in UConn. So how about this? Next week, we'll tell people why we're in UConn.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have more transportation and logistical gems to talk about, but I do believe, I think this concert here is about to get started. I think they've done a sound check, and the band has arrived.
Oh, you know, I noticed there's several hundred people that are gathered around us. I just assumed it was because of Off the Wall.
Yeah, I think they are actually here for someone else.
Well, okay, I'll just have to process that then. Well, folks, write to us, otw@2600.com. We will be back next week, and we promise we'll explain why we're in the UConn. We'll probably have more adventures. You know what? In fact, let's have some adventures so that we'll have something to talk about next week. Good night.
So long.
I took a contract to bury the body of blasphemous Bill McCod. Whenever, wherever, or whatsoever, the manner of death he died. Oh, whether he died in the light of day or under the peak-faced moon, in cabin or dance hall, camp or dive, mucklucks or patent shoon, on velvet tundra or virgin peak, by glacier drift or draw, in musky hollow or canyon gloom, by avalanche, fang or claw, by battle, murder, a sudden wealth, by pestilence, hooch or lead, I swore on the book I would travel and look till I found my tombless dead. Years passed away, and at last one day came a squaw with a story strange of a long deserted line of traps way back of the Bighorn Range, and a little hut by the Great Divide, and a white man stiff and still lying there by his lonesome self. I figured it must be Bill, so I thought of the contract I made with him, and I took it down from the shelf, and the swell black box with the silver plate that he picked out for himself, and I filled it full of hooch and grub, and I slung it on the sleigh, and I harnessed up my teams of dogs and was off at the dawn of day. You know what it's like in the Yukon wild when it's 69 below, when the ice worms wiggle their purple heads through the crust of the pale blue snow, where the pine trees crackle like little guns in the silence of the wood, and the icicles hang down like tusks under the parka hood. Oh, it was north by north through a land of curse, shunned by the scoring brutes, and all I heard was my own harsh word and the whine of the Malamutes, till at last I came to a cabin squat built in the side of a hill. And I burst in the door, and there on the floor, frozen to death, lay Bill. Have you ever stood in an Arctic hut in the shadow of the pole, with a little coffin 6x3 and a grief you can't control? Have you ever looked at a frozen corpse that looks at you with a grin, that seems to say you may try all day, but you'll never shove me in? For he was hard as a log and trussed like a frog, with his arms and legs outspread. I looked at the coffin I brought for him, and I looked at the gruesome dead. Then I rose and kicked off the husky dogs that was nosing round about, and I lit a roaring fire in the stove, and it started to thaw Bill out. Well, I thought and thought for 13 days, but it didn't do no good. His arms and legs stuck out like pegs, as if they was made of wood. Till at last I said, well, it ain't no use, he's froze too hard to thaw. He's ostinate and he won't lie straight, so I guess I got to saw. So I sawed off poor Bill's arms and legs, and I laid him neat and straight in the little coffin that he picked for himself with the dinky silver plate. And I came nigh near to shedding a tear as I laid him safely down, and I stowed him away in my Yukon sleigh, and I headed back to town. So I buried him, as the contract said, in a narrow grave and deep, and there he's waiting the great clean-up when the judgment's loosehead sweep. And I smoke my pipe, and I meditate in the light of the midnight sun, and I sometimes wonder if they was these awful things I've done. And as I sit and the parson talks, expounding on the law, I often think of poor old Bill and how hard he was to saw.
Are you ready for your order?
Yes, I'll have the college radio station with the hand-picked music, fresh interviews, and let's get a side of locally grown events.
Sure thing.
Oh, you know what? Make that 24/7.
No problem. You got it.
Oh, and that doesn't come with any advertisements, does it? I'm deathly allergic.
It's actually 100% ad-free.
Perfect. How much?
It's actually free.
Free? What? How?
It's brought to you by listeners just like you.
How do I help?
You could donate by calling 631-632-6901 or by going on www.wusb.fm.
I'm going to leave a fat tip.